the way that a con artist works is they trade on trust. They have to have your absolute trust. And then once they have your absolute trust, they take you. They take you for everything that that you have. And if you look at how we're dying in the United States right now, I think it's a con.
Alex Drain has done many things in healthcare, but they all have a common theme: how to bring empathy and humanity to the healthcare experience. Her work and mission have centered around topics that most of us consider to be unmentionable: relationships, sex, loneliness, vulnerability, and death, to name a few. Her work has had a profound impact on so many people, and yet, what she really wanted to be was a race car driver.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm David Chewitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan.
Die big. Work in a few posthumous reflexes for your friends. You know, the body does store electricity up, and even a dead body, a corpse, will occasionally go... And I say, if you have that potential after you're dead, use it properly. Reprogram some posthumous reflexes that will be entertaining to those you've left behind. Do something to capture their imagination. Roll over on the autopsy table.
That's nice.
Cross your legs, scratch your balls, do something.
You gotta love George Carlin for his ability to bring humor to topics like death. It's one of the things that's so amazing and inspiring about you, Alex. You were talking about end of life and how to bring grace and humanity to that topic long before anyone had coined the term death panel. What drew you to the death topic, the dying gracefully topic? And can you tell us more about your work here?
Yes. So you make it sound so much more exciting, the way that you introduce it. Thank you for that. So we actually lost my sister-in-law to glioblastoma, brain cancer, when she was 32. It was a horrific experience in so many ways. Clearly losing someone, any point in life, losing someone so young. She had a almost three-year-old daughter. And it wasn't until reflection after the fact and looking back, because I think you're so shell-shocked in general when you lose somebody, but especially the way that people die today, for the most part, in the United States. And in looking back on it, I think what struck me was how we were so educated. I work in the healthcare system, and we brought all of our best intent and all of our resources and all of our education, and we still did a terrible, terrible job caring for her. And not because we didn't love her ferociously, we were there with her every single day, and not because we didn't have all those resources I just mentioned, it was because two reasons. The system doesn't know how to let somebody go, and we had never had conversations about it. We as a family didn't know how to work through that together. And what struck me, again, it took a while, and the literature shows that especially in a case where over-treatment occurs, which happens in many situations when someone's dying, that the impact on the caregivers, the people who are caring for them, often results in depression. Literally 6 months out, you're much more likely to be depressed if you cared for someone who was over-treated at end of life. And when all that fog lifted and we had more clarity and perspective, what I was struck with is that we just, it can't happen this way. If it was so bad for me, how would it be for somebody who didn't have all the things that we did, who didn't have all the resources that we did? And so wanted to do something about it.
So what are you doing about it?
Well, so the first thing that we did was we came down to the conclusion that the reason we had done so badly was because we had never had the discussion as a family. And I realized that so few people that I knew actually were talking about this. And so thought about, well, what's a way that we could just create a tool that would give people the excuse to start talking about it? And I'm sure you guys have heard the old adage that if you want to get a teenager talking, or if you want to get, I'm sorry to say this, David, but a man talking, you're supposed to get him in the car so you're not looking at each other and you're looking forward, and then you can talk about topics that might feel uncomfortable. So the thought was, well, what if we created
a slide? Great idea.
It's great, and it really does work. I use it all the time now. So what if we created a slide, one piece of paper, and on it had just 5 questions, because I think the other thing that happens when people think about talking about death and the way that you do it now with lawyers and a lot of the circumstances where this topic comes up is it feels overwhelming, it feels daunting, And so the idea was to pull, really to normalize it, to pull all of the stress out of it, to have this one sheet of paper that you could put in between the two of you that would ask you just five simple questions about how you wanted to die. And the notion would be that you should be able to answer these questions for yourself and answer them for your loved ones. And then the way that we wanted to make it viral was we called this one slide the One Slide Project, and we entreated everybody, please pass this along. So as soon as you've heard about this, make it your mission, whether you're at your book club, you're giving a talk, you're at work, you're ending a meeting, whatever it might be, that you too will put this one slide up and say to the audience or to your friends or whoever's there, let's make sure that we know what these answers are. There are no wrong answers. The only wrong answer is if you just don't know what your answer is or someone couldn't describe it for you.
Now, this seems like it's a topic that's very much that a lot of people are, I guess maybe a better way to ask it is, it seems very much in the news. It seems like there's a lot of discussion around this. I think, was it Minnesota, Wisconsin? There's a state that has an incredibly high rate of being able to do this, that it's frequently profiled. Atul Gawande's wonderful book that was recently published. Finally, now that quote, the conversation is now actually being covered right after that whole, all those issues around that. So in the New York Times was described to me by a hospice doctor as actually the journal of record for hospice care. They're publishing so many articles on end of life care.
Yeah.
That was actually at the Messinex conference. I was sitting next to a guy and he was saying, that they should call them. I was saying, aren't there a lot of articles about what you're doing in the New York Times? And he said, yeah, it should be it's basically the journal of record because more useful stuff is public. They've really made it a project.
So why now? Why do you think, Alex? Why now has it suddenly become okay to talk about?
Well, first of all, I have to start by saying I'm so grateful for that. I mean, when we got started doing this way back when, about 2008, it was something that nobody talked about, but it wasn't taboo. And people would be uncomfortable at it, but they would engage. And in 2011, when the death panel fiasco happened, that was a catastrophe. And you couldn't get anyone to touch this. And I was doing some work with some groups that were organized down on the Hill. And, my perspective when the death panel, term was coined was, let's use this to our advantage. Let's turn around right now and say to people, that's exactly right. Down with death panels. Death panels are bad. That's why you should be having the conversation to tell people what you want. But that was not considered, something that would be appropriate at that time. And so instead, people went deeply underground. I think a couple of things are happening. First and foremost, the sheer volume of us who have had horrific experiences, and if not directly with our own family members, with watching other folks go through it, in a world where this new, empowered consumer is not just getting cranky when this happened, it's not just horror for them, but they have the opportunity to share these stories publicly. And technology really supports this sort of peer-to-peer revolution. At the same time, that just the sheer demographics of the silver tsunami, when I think about it, just the numbers of folks for whom this will become a reality, and the total amount of dollars that are spent on end of life is something that we never talked about before.
Well, but so I want to get to that because I feel like that's one of the reasons that makes the topic so complicated, because there are two issues that I feel like are really conflated. And one is that the care that's given to people at the end of life now is often not what they want, is inconsistent with their value system, had anybody asked and then respected that choice. So that seems one argument that I can, that I imagine everybody else can get behind. But I think what concerns some people, including me, is this other issue, the idea that then people say, and then there's the whole cost issue. Because that's a related, but in a sense, morally, it seems a very distinct issue. And I think what there's a lot of concern is that if there's a whole emphasis on pushing people, I mean, let's say the pendulum swings so much the other way that you have like this Logan's Run scenario where you're essentially, when people are sort of outlive their usefulness, it's sort of like, well, let's save the system money and do the right thing and, make it the default thing not to have any type of, end of life care that maybe the patient, the person might have actually wanted. I had an experience like that with one of my uncles where,
That was what happened. He had pancreatic cancer. Actually, it was at a, you know, literally actually at Sloan Kettering, and basically he had then he got pneumonia, and then the oncologist was like, let him go. You know, it's like, why would you know? It's a blessing. Let him, you know, let him go. They didn't want to treat him for a completely treatable form of pneumonia, and we had to completely, really brutally fight this sort of very sort of cynical, bitter oncologist to actually get him treatment. And he was successfully treated, and he had many more months of life that he specifically wanted, where he enjoyed playing with his grandkids, where he enjoyed going to a graduation, where he enjoyed going to a lot of events. And so I felt it was an example where, in this case, not necessarily for money, but basically because the person was so cynical, but there's, how do you, on the one hand, respect the choices that you're describing, but at the same time, not have a system where maybe motivated by some financial considerations, everyone starts getting pushed, you know, it's considered selfish to want care that a patient might actually want. How do you balance those?
Yeah, so I think it's an incredibly important point. And I'll just start with, the statistics are that 70% of people want to die at home, and only 30% of people do. And the vast majority of individuals never have an opportunity to make an informed choice. So nobody ever sits down with them and says, okay, you could have this treatment or this treatment, and if you have this treatment, this is really what will happen, and if you have that treatment, this is what will happen. And I think the reason the financial aspect is important, and of course there is the risk that what you're describing could happen, just like there's the very real truth right now that the opposite is happening, which is because the system does make a lot of money, maybe intentionally, maybe unintentionally.
Yeah, Farzad always makes that point whenever we debate this on Twitter.
It's over-treating you, and that is just, anyone who's watched that 70% of people who would much rather be at home, you know, have their ribs broken as they're having chemo on the last day of life, that's horror as well. And, you know, I want to launch a movement called A Bad Death is a Con. One of the things that I think we're not talking about a lot, so I do a lot of work in the financial fraud and abuse of seniors space, and I do that because someone who's very close to me was taken advantage of by a con artist. And as I was going through this process, which was, you know, horrifying in and of itself, of somebody who's very educated and very financially sophisticated. So con artists don't just take advantage of people, you know, little old ladies sitting at their table. No, 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 no. I started seeing all these parallels. The way that a con artist works is they trade on trust. They have to have your absolute trust. And then once they have your absolute trust, they take you. They take you for everything that you have. And if you look at how we're dying in the United States right now, I think it's a con. So 25% of seniors lose all of their assets in the last 5 years of life. And that jumps to 41% if you don't take into consideration housing. So what's happening is we're not getting the death that we want, and it's bankrupting us in the process. So what I'm trying to do, and I'll add one other quick thing, which is when I would say to somebody, this person that I love is being taken advantage of by a con artist, people get so indignant. It's like their whole body would change, and they would stand up straight, and they would say to me, oh, that is unacceptable. How do I help? What do we do? During this period, that same person had something bad happen to them health-wise, as you can imagine from all the stress. And when I would say to somebody, oh, well, this beloved person of mine just had something bad happen to them health-wise, it's like they had the exact opposite physical reaction. Their shoulders would roll. They would just look dejected and as though they had no sense that they could do anything for me, and they would walk away. And so part of what I think we need to do in the end-of-life space is to change our language. And we have to get people fired up and have to get them to feel angry and frustrated. And essentially, we need to march on how badly this situation is right now. And what makes me feel hopeful is I think the baby boomers, in general, don't like when things don't go their way. And they changed how we were born, and they changed how we work and how we marry. And I have every hope that one of the reasons we're beginning to see so much energy is not just because of the beauty of someone like Atul Gawande, who writes about this so extraordinarily that it's a top seller,
absolutely,
right? But because it's something that the baby boomers, when they hear about this, their immediate reaction is, well, that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable that I'm being essentially tortured, or that my mother is being tortured, that the system makes this so hard. And when I say something as inflammatory, it's a bad death as a con, I really do believe, having worked in this space forever, but that people do have the best intent. They are trying. The system as a whole is failing. And so where I believe the only movements, only efforts that I've ever been part of that I've been able to make work actually weren't focused on getting doctors to change their behavior. It was focused on getting humans to change their behavior. And I think
so
if we
the,
go on.
Well, so one of the more extreme things that I've heard proposed, both by Jonathan Bush, obviously speaking of being provocative, and then it was actually raised, NPR asked Zeke Emanuel, who actually didn't think it was a good idea, but basically to say, okay, well, a way to change a system is you change financial incentives. So essentially you sort of say to tell people, well, and I think they do it in so the country, I forget which country does it, but essentially you say, okay, here's some amount of money that if you don't have heroic measures or however you define that, that there's some fixed amount of money that is available for either your quote end of life care, or if you, you know, go to hospice or do something that is felt to be less, consuming of resources, that money then goes to health for your kids or for your family or like that. The money, it sort of tries to make concrete the money that's being saved. And, you know, Zeke didn't like it. And I agree with him because the sort of the ethics of it were a little bit questionable. But on the other hand, the economics of it were just making what sort of a very, not very transparent sort of issue to many, very transparent, just saying here, there's a lot of money that's being wasted, and if you save it, your kids will benefit.
So I'm all for changing financial incentives in the healthcare space. Absolutely. If at the pace that we have been able to change things so far, I'm too impatient to wait for that. And I actually think you don't even need to have I mean, think about the statistic I just told you. 25% of seniors lose all their assets in the last 5 years of life, and that number is really as high as 41%. What needs to happen is families need to give each other permission to talk about this stuff. We as a culture, and that is happening, right? There was a gentleman that I used to date in the olden days who just thought my job couldn't have been less impressive. He is in the whole Hollywood space. And about a year ago, he reached out and wanted to talk to me about my end-of-life work. This is becoming a mainstream topic. This is becoming something that's actually even cool, right? In the olden days, if I said I'm really fascinated in the end-of-life space, people thought I was weird, and they would turn their back and they couldn't walk away fast enough. So part
might have been the black hood and the scythe that you walk around with.
Yes, of course, absolutely. My style. I think the challenge for us as a culture, and I believe the opportunity for us as a culture, is that when people give themselves permission to sit down and talk about this, using any of the tools that are available today, Engage with Grace is a wonderful one. There are a lot of other ones that exist now too. But when you get families just to sit down and talk about stuff, two things happen. Like Death Over Dinner, for example, is another great movement. I love it. A couple things happen. Number one, people actually really enjoy talking about it. They really do. They learn things about each other. And the best time to have that conversation is before you need to have it, as far back before you need to have it as possible, so that you become comfortable with the topic, so then when you need to have the conversation, it's much easier for you to get it started. And if you do things like that, then the next layer on that, which is the financial implications, David, I think you're right to be wary of that. However, I've seen families, once they are given transparency or clarity around how much this stuff is costing, at the same time that they're having the discussion about what do you want, right? So my beautiful sister-in-law spent 3 of her last 7 months essentially in the hospital. She had a 2.5-year-old daughter. That was a terrible, terrible, terrible choice. I wish someone had sat down with us and said, here is the treatment that you're taking right now. It means you're likely to be immobilized. It means you're likely to be in this hospital room. By the way, remember what a hospital room feels like to your daughter, right? This will be very disarming to her, and you won't feel good. You'll be in pain all the time. An alternative is, let us introduce you to palliative care. You wouldn't even have to say hospice care. I know a lot of people have a hard time with hospice care. Personally, I think it's like concierge care, and we should rebrand it. But just to introduce the notion of quality of life on equal footing with curative care when somebody is facing an end-of-life decision, trajectory, we would have made different decisions. But there was no conversation along those lines, and we didn't get exposed to that information. So I think what I would love to do is incite people to feel entitled, which is usually a word I hate, but to feel fired up to be making sure that the choices that they're making with intention, and that they are informed with information about both sides.
You know, Alex, you're such a product of your family, and your family has obviously inspired you so much to on your professional work. Tell us a little bit about that. You once told me that, you are a mix of your dad's, commitment to be a tech platform and your mom's commitment to be a human platform. You know, just tell us about how that's led you to where you are.
Well, I'm super blessed. So my dad is a serial entrepreneur and had a company called Atex that he sold to Kodak. And when my parents got divorced, the way that I would spend time with my dad is he would take me with him to meetings. And I would get to sit in the back of the room under, you know, the strictest, you better not open your mouth kind of clause. And I was, you know, back in the olden days where you would get swatted if you didn't do things the right way. So I sat in the back of the room. I didn't say a word. But as time went on, I got, you know, more and more responsibility. By the time I was 18, he would often have me speak on his behalf. I became his proxy.
Wow.
Yeah, it was so cool. And I just, for all of the folks that I know listen to and love you guys so much, we should do that more as parents. Any chance I get now to bring my kids to with me to work, I do the same thing. I say, if you so much as open your mouth, I will take away everything you own. You are not allowed to say a word. But then they sit there, and for me, watching conflict and watching stress and watching people work things through never felt scary. It felt normal. And I never
begrudged need to go to work for that. But.
Yeah, right.
That's true. That's a very, very good point. Well, but that's a great point. Most people do feel comfortable with that at home, but then they freak out when that happens in the workplace, even though it's really normal. So I got really exposed through my dad from a very, very young age to being around emerging technologies because he, as an angel investor, that was what he was obsessed with. And then I have a mom who has had all these different careers over time. She was a CPA who built her own practice. At one point, we're Quaker, and she got frustrated feeling like all she was doing was helping rich people get richer. So she quit to go build alternative housing systems for homeless women and their children who were stuck off on 128 with no transportation. So she converted an abandoned large house down in Roxbury and just did extraordinary things for these women, with them all taking turns caring for each other and getting them into school. Then she did a turnaround. Then the money dried up. She did a turnaround for a mental health institution, and then decided that what she really wanted to do was help with infant malnutrition, and the best way to do that was to go help make breastfeeding the standard of care and more of a best practice in a world where formula companies were taking over. And so she became a lactation consultant. So I have incredibly extraordinary, and I have a stepfather who's been with me forever who's also extraordinary. So just very activist, very engaged, super informed parents who were constantly treating, sort of involving us in what they were doing as though we were equal. So we never really had a chance to think of business as that thing or of changing the world as that thing that somebody else does. It was like, no, of course that's what you do. That's your default, that you would start with that as your goal.
Now, I know you also have kids, and that you have, you know, said to me that the message you want them to understand is that you're not leaving work to get your nails, or leaving home, excuse me, to get your nails done, that you're leaving home to change the world. Do you engage them in the types of discussions that you talk about so publicly, like through your work with the Unmentionables? I mean, do you guys sit around the dinner table
talking about unmentionable topics?
Talking about, you know, big issues like death and relationships and vulnerability and all those things. Have you brought them into your world?
And have you thought about serving as a consultant?
So we absolutely do. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got was from a woman, from Suzanne Dolbenko, actually, who most of you probably know now with CPR. Before that, she was the founder of the Leapfrog Group. And she and I were both pregnant with our second at the same time. And I was lamenting how I had left that morning to go on this business trip, which I was with her. And I had said to my daughter as I walked out the door, like, Mommy is so sorry to be leaving you. I'm so sorry to leave you. I wish I didn't have to go. And Susanna said to me, look, what are you talking about? That's what you're basically then saying to your kid is it's out of your control and you don't want to do it. And then it feels like the world is doing something to them. What you should say to them instead is, you know, I'm going to miss you a lot, but I am heading out to go make a difference, which I then translated into, which I said to my kids until they were old enough to call bull crap on me. Mama is heading out to change the world. I'm going to go save the world. This is what I'm doing. And then I heard this other woman say once that there should be no such thing as mother guilt, and the reason she said it, because she would want her children to work. And so we talk all the time in our house about what are we trying to do on a regular basis to make a difference. And the other thing I believe in strongly is sharing the stuff that's not working as much as you're sharing the stuff that does. So our conversations at night will often be, well, here's a thing I really screwed up on. I really had worked harder on it, but it didn't work out. And so this is what I'm learning, and this is what I'm doing differently. And then we'll have that same conversation where they're concerned, and always trying to say how important is humility, how important is grit and determination, how important it is to share with each other generously the things that we don't feel so good about, so other people can learn from it, so other people can feel better about themselves, because we know we're all walking around tortured. And then underlying all of that is, and what in that is what is your goal within that to help make other people's lives better? Whatever better might be. Better might just be making other people happier, right? Or it could be helping other people have food. I mean, there's a whole spectrum, but it needs to be about doing for others.
Well, one of the things you've done really well, I think, is help people feel better about some very difficult topics. And I know you started this program called The Unmentionables with Health 2.0. It's always the most well-attended session of that conference every year. And, you know, people respond to it in a very powerful way. What was the inspiration for that? And maybe you can tell people about the vulnerability index and what role that plays.
So there are really two things. The first is the actual moment was I was driving to work late one day, and I had had a breakfast meeting. And I, for whatever reason, you know how sometimes something catches your eye, I saw this man walking down the street, and he was holding the hand of this beautiful little girl. And I looked at him, and he just, you know, being in the healthcare industry, you sort of like tick down all the things that were probably wrong with him. He had that belly. I'm sure he was full in type 2 diabetes. He had all sorts of cardiovascular issues, clearly looked very blue. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, my company, with all the best intentions, sometime in the next week or month or year, we're going to reach out to him on behalf of one of the local payers. We worked with all of them. And we're going to lecture him about his health. We're going to tell him they better be taking his medications, they better be on his diabetes care. And this guy doesn't need that. He needs a job, right? He needs a job. And then we started sort of pulling on that a little bit and looking back on all the data that we had collected. When I was at Eliza, we had done over 1 billion interactions with people. And often we would say, go get your mammogram, get your colon cancer screening, take care of your asthma, whatever it might be. And then we'd ask a follow-up question, do you plan on doing it? And far too frequently, someone would say no, and so we would say, well, why not? And we'd run through the reasons that we thought, like it must be cost or transportation or fear of finding out the results, and people would be like, no, it's because I can't prioritize it right now. My mom just lost her job, my husband just lost his job, I'm caring for an aging parent. And so what we sort of came to eventually was a framework that I love, Maslow's hierarchy, and I think the healthcare industry very lovingly, with all the best intentions, is focused on the top of the hierarchy of needs, trying to get people to live their best life, exercise, eat more, you know, take care of your condition, take this medication. Meanwhile, the stress of just trying to survive, you know, caregiver stress, financial stress, relationship stress, workplace stress, has most of us in a small panic on a regular basis, barely coping. And then if you go even down further, far too many of folks in our country don't have the basics. They don't have safety. They don't have heat. They don't have, you know, ability to get clothing. They don't have food. And so what I came back to is maybe we're focused on the wrong stuff. And the reason we can't reliably, sustainably, scalably bend trend is because if I think my husband's cheating on me and my mother with Alzheimer's just moved in, and increasingly the only answer that I can find is at the bottom of a bottle, am I thinking about my diabetes? No, I don't have the luxury of that. So maybe we need to be focusing on what's actually driving these illnesses. And in fact, if you go look at the literature, and we were able to show this with our own data, in fact, it is true. When you have these life challenges happen, you're at twice the risk of developing a chronic disease, twice the risk of depression, your telomeres are shortening. The influence of life on health is profound, and not only does it keep you from focusing on taking care of yourself, it actually hurts you. It hurts your health at the same time.
And then how does this connect with the concept of unmentionables, though? I mean, one of our favorite guests we had, what was it now?
Kelly Brzoski.
At the very, almost the beginning of our podcast, you know, was a person who, wow, what did she rebrand it as? But basically people who were sort of having a little bit of fecal leakage and has a butterfly health, right? A product for that. And, you know, has a whole company around it. And then it turns out that there, you know, I know you talk about this so frequently, a range of topics that are like, is that just sort of even more specific that not only do people have life stuff going on, but within that, there's sort of a subcategory of issues that just are really getting them. I mean, I guess you could even put something that before there's like a product report for a solution, something like ED, before it was something that you could call ED, whatever it was, like who would have guessed that there was this massive market for something like that around? That's like, seems to me almost a classic example of, you know, here's an unmentionable topic and now I can't watch baseball with my kids because there's a Viagra ad, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know what the right balance is, but like it's an example where you're able to, by someone being able to actually just, you know, highlight something, you're able to, you know, sort of get to something that might be bothering people and isn't, you know, but one can't talk about it and to talk, you know, and it seems that basically everything involves like bowels or sex. Is that right, Lisa?
Well, not in my conversations, but maybe in Alex's.
You just talk about two of my favorite things. Let's stay there. So the reason we called it the Unmentionables was because we felt as though these were the most important topics. These were the things that were most defining somebody's reality and actually somebody's health. But because we felt uncomfortable talking about it, that we were ignoring it. And so the goal was to make this mainstream. You know, I think there's another important aspect to this, which is for me, why do I care so much about this? Like, I certainly care about it because of the impact on people's health, and that's measurable. But what I have experienced when these things happen to me is you just feel so alone. Right. So something you think you're sucking at work, or you're worried that you're doing a terrible job caring for an aging parent, whatever it might be. And so that thing is hurting you. And then you feel like you're the only one who's suffering with that. And then you feel like a loser for being the only one from suffering that. It's like double jeopardy in some way. Right. Like it's this bad thing's right. happening. And then you feel so alone and tortured in it. And the reality is almost everybody at any point in time, 95% of people are struggling with at least one unmentionable, and 40% are struggling with between 4 and 6. It's actually one of the most common realities of humanity. And I think by bringing it out into the light, then we give people a chance to first and foremost, what matters to me the most is to help people feel less alone in it. You are not alone in this thing that you're struggling with. We're all sucking at a lot of stuff. And that's, you know, first line of treatment. The other thing I think is really interesting is the extent to which the healthcare industry is relying on what I would call inaccurate data in thinking about where to set priorities. And I'll go back to that example of financial fraud and abuse of seniors. There was a study that was done by MetLife in 2010, I think it was published, that said that the size of that problem is $2.6 billion. And then somebody who was working in it, a gentleman who runs this company called TrueLink, started talking about this with around the country and realized everybody had a story. It was like, oh my gosh. Once he would get this topic up, people were like, oh yeah, that happened to my mother, or it happened to my aunt, it happened to my neighbor. Everyone had a story. So he said, you know what, I'm going to go back and I'm going to look at the survey tool that they did to come out with $2.6 billion. And it was what all other survey tools in the healthcare system are. It was shaming. So it basically asked the question, are you an idiot? And you got taken advantage of. To which, of course, we were like, no, I'm not an idiot. It's like the Living with Heart Failure survey says, does your condition make you feel like a burden to your friends and family? Oh, my God. I not until now. Now I feel like I'm a burden to friends and family.
Right. But the concept of making it difficult.
Why don't you screen me for depression at the same time? So they went back. Well, let me just tell you the number really quickly because it's shocking. So they went back and they redid the survey, asking questions that were more a series of facts. Tell me if these series of facts have happened to you as opposed to shaming type questions. How much bigger do you think the market actually is?
10 times.
Yeah, it's 12 times bigger. It's 12 times bigger.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
So I think that the biggest opportunity with these unmentionables, first and foremost, is to help people feel less alone. And then we start getting accurate information about how real the order of magnitude of things for people. And then maybe we would start allocating resources. We have scarce resources. Maybe we would start allocating those resources differently. And maybe instead of building another diabetes app, we would build an app that would help you with your divorce, because going through a divorce is as bad on your health as diabetes or smoking, as an example.
Yeah, you know, I just reminded of Alex and I share something in common besides the mutual love for each other, which is our favorite movie is The Princess Bride.
The Dread Pirate Roberts never takes prisoners.
I can't afford to make exceptions. I mean, once word leaks out that a pirate has gone soft, people begin to disobey you, and then it's nothing but work, work, work all the time.
You mock my pain.
Life is pain, Highness. Anyone who says differently is selling something.
These are very painful topics, and, you know, we are talking about people who are selling things to solve them, but you always approach them with such almost joy and positivity, and I think it changes the dynamic of the story so much, and I think that's really an incredible lesson for the people who are selling things to solve these problems, is how to make them not shameful, but to make them, you know, human, joyful, you know, at least positive. You know, so we need to wrap up, but I'm going to have one quick last question. I know you have a good answer for this, because what you told me is that despite all the things you've done in tech and healthcare and everything, you really always wanted to be a race car driver. So in a quick answer, what's that about?
I love going fast. I love it. I love speed and I love to win. I'm extraordinarily, intensely, ferociously, aggressively competitive. And I feel badly about being that way in much of my life. So when I get in my car, I'm going to race and I'm going to win and I don't feel badly about it. And I cannot wait till I can take that to the track. I've gone a couple times, but someday I'm going to be a race car driver.
Well, I hope you fill out your end of life form before you go. Thank you so much, Alex. Really appreciate your time today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Alex. Have fun storming the castle.
I think you guys rock. Thank you very, very much. I'm very honored. I'm very, 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 very grateful for the opportunity.
Wow, what an amazing person, Lisa.
Yeah, I mean, she's always such a bright light of energy. And even when she's talking about things that make people so uncomfortable, you know, I think the fact that she's able to make people inspired and comfortable about them is the germ of that is what we need to find in the conversations that people have with their doctors, you know, that insurance companies need to find as they're helping manage patients. It's just such an important aspect that we don't think about enough in healthcare.
Wow, couldn't agree more. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. This is Tectonics.
You can always find me on my blog at venturevalkyrie.com and David, who writes prolifically for Forbes.
Also, we're both on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.